Coming up this week in computer hardware, Samsung's got new 860 SSD drives, Lenovo's Legion C730 gaming cube, Drobo's 8D Dash reviewed, Terra Fears, and some pretty awesome mouse skates. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 493, recorded on November 29th, 2018. Cheap SSDs, dead RTX GPUs, and mouse feet. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, a podcast from Red Hat. Listen to the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels revolutionizing the technology landscape. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit redhat.com/heroes today. And by OnDeck. Are you a small business owner in need of capital today? Well, OnDeck can help. With over $10 billion in loans and an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau, OnDeck is a lender you can trust. Visit OnDeck.com/Twitch to learn more and receive a free consultation with one of their U.S.-based loan specialists. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch Weekly Show that aims to bring you the most useful, most delightful, most engaging, most informative, most curious, most awesome, most terrifying, most death-defying coverage of PC, console, mobile, laptop, desktop, single board, computer, and occasionally cat box cleaners available on the internet. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Alan Malventano, who normally doesn't have his name spoken like it's in slow motion. Sorry about that, Alan.
That's okay. Sometimes people have to sound it out. It's a little, you know, you're better than most. Usually,
well, I know how to say your name. I just don't know what just happened. Apparently, my overclocking. There was a thermal shutdown on my overclocking unit.
So that's what happens. It's what happens. You know, as the hair goes away and the laps around the sun count up.
Wow.
You know, it's just those things. It's happening here too.
I think I've just been mocked for aging. So. As tempting as it is to call you out as an ageist SOB, I'll do that in private time without the civility of the internet between you and I. We should talk about StoreCentric's Drobo 8D DAS review. Now, I actually have a 5-bay DAS or desktop attached storage that I use, which is convenient, right? Because I can back up, you know, 11 terabytes of stuff that's attached to my computer via USB 3 on my regular account that I back everything else up with, which is something you can't do with a NAS. I'm talking about Backblaze and actually several other places. I'm going to assume that between the 8 bays and maybe the Thunderbolt 3, this thing is faster than a 5-bay unit.
Yes, it's faster than, I think this is probably the fastest Drobo product to date. There have been other NASs and direct attached storage things that will typically be faster, even than this, perhaps. But Drobos tend to kind of lag behind a little bit because they have all that extra secret sauce stuff going on that lets you mix and match hard drive sizes. And, you know, it just deals with failures and power failures and other types of things in a more robust manner. And there's usually trade-offs associated with that, the main one usually being performance in you know, as far as Drobos go. This one's pretty good, though. So Thunderbolt 3, 8 bays, and even without the use of a caching SSD, which you can install in this, they've changed it to a 2.5-inch slot that's in the rear of the unit. Before, they used to be mSATAs behind a little trapdoor kind of thing. Now it's just like almost looks like a you know, like a micro SD card slot, only much bigger, and just for a SATA SSD. Even without the use of that, I was able to get 1.1 gig per second reads and over 400 meg per second writes, which is impressive in Drobo terms, definitely. I also did have an opportunity to point out, since the gap keeps spreading wider and wider between what you see on synthetic tests on a Drobo specifically versus actually just copying the file, you know, from the system to the Drobo, right?
Right.
So if you go down a couple of charts, there's this. I just figured I might as well just lay these out. And so this is Thunderbolt 3, currently Mac only. They do not have a Windows driver for the Thunderbolt interface of this particular system yet. They've said one's coming, but we don't have it. So that leaves you with a subset of storage benchmarks on Mac. Blackmagic Disk Speed Test is the very common one that, you know, usually if you've tested an SSD or a hard drive on a Mac, you've probably used that tool. When you hit the Drobo with that particular test, you end up getting like half of the actual read performance. And that just boils down to that test just doesn't mesh nicely with the extra layers that the data has to pass through when it's talking to something like a Drobo. Drobo tried to alleviate this. They came up with their own little performance tool that if I run that with just the defaults, I get better results, but again, not the full speed. And in order to do the full speed, we just did a simple test. Just take a big, like 32 gig, you know, media file. I think it was just a movie. And we just copied it from it. Good old fashioned stopwatch test, right?
Right.
And we ended up getting, you know, the results in the bottom of that chart, which is, you know, 1.1 gig per second, like 450 meg per second on the writes. This was with all 8 bays full. They were 7,200 RPM drives. They were mixed in capacity, but the drives were mostly empty, so it doesn't come into play that much when you mix the capacity of drives. The performance hits start to show up as you fill the drives. Just the way that Drobo's, you know, kind of file system works. They made some changes with these models over prior Drobos, like the original Drobo and like the Drobo Pro and things like that. They would make a volume that was larger than, well, theoretically larger than the disks that were installed. It's called thin provisioning, right? It makes it easier. It makes your partition one time. You never have to expand it or resize it or anything. It's just, it is what it is. But there's a little bit of feedback in from the standpoint of there's a set of blue LEDs along the right edge of the front of the Drobo that shows you how full it actually is. And if you have the Drobo software installed on the system, you can, you know, see it there as well. And if you didn't pay attention to any of that and you started to try to what would be overfill the space, it actually slows down the writes as it gets to the very end where, you know, it just doesn't have anywhere to put the data. You know, it slows down writes so that hopefully the user would start to pay attention and go, oh, I've actually filled up my drives, right? I got to add another one.
I'm going to break things.
yeah. It just kind of like tapers off so that you would never be able to actually fill it up all the way because you'd just never be able to get there. It just, you know, keeps slowing it down further and further. But with the Drobo Pro way back 9 years ago, I ended up looking back at when I was getting this review ready. And we reviewed Drobo Pro 9 years ago. Man, that's a long time I've been making these things. and that wasn't even the first one, right? They had the original Drobo, like the 4-bay unit that came out, you know, even like a year prior to that, I believe. That unit would only be able to make a volume size of 16 terabytes. Now, at the time, it'd be hard-pressed to even find 16 terabytes worth of drives to put in the thing. Now, granted, you can make multiple volumes, and they're all pointing to the same pool of disks. But those limitations have since expanded with this Drobo 8D. The volume limit is 128 terabytes, and the drive pool, like the total capacity of drives installed limit, is 256 terabytes. And these are base 2 numbers, not like hard disk math numbers where you buy like an 8 terabyte hard drive and it actually shows up as like 7.3 or something. Right. So you can, you know, it's even healthier of an amount of capacity that's there and can be addressed and accessed and whatnot. The original Drobo Pro, the transfer speeds were like 80 megabytes per second, just to put things in perspective. So we're going, you know, like more than 10 times faster here. Yeah, not bad. Then to wrap it up, we get to the price. Now, I don't remember what the original Jiroba Pro sold for. It was definitely up there. There have been other 8-bay Jiroba models since the Jiroba Pro, but they were all enterprise kind of oriented. And those sold for $1,700 for just the unit, not even any drives. 8D brings the price down a little bit, $1,300. But you've got to really want that speed in those extra three bays, because you can get something like a Jiroba 5C, which, you know, was also like USB 3. It was able to, I think that can also, yeah. USB 3, it went like 350, 400 meg per second reads and writes. It wasn't doing 1.1 gig per second, sure, but the performance was reasonable for what it was, and that was a 5-bay unit, and you can get them for $300. So that's like $1,000 of a price difference between the three extra bays and the caching and the faster read speeds. So, yeah, it's kind of a hard sell. I would imagine the price would come down some. When I was just poking around just to compare prices before this review, those B810 models, those enterprise 8-bay models I was talking about that were $1,700 at launch, you can pick up one of those for like $1,000, $1,100 these days. So, I would expect that $1,300 price to hopefully come down just a little bit. And they direct sell these, so they occasionally do promotions. Last week, they were running a Black Friday, Cyber Monday style promotion where they just included, I think it was like a 250 gig 860 Evo as a caching drive. Like, just if you bought one, they would just throw in a drive for you to stick in the back and, you know, help speed up random reads, since you'd be ideally reading those off of the SSD and way quicker than you could do random reads from a bunch of hard disks that have to seek and whatnot. But
as somebody who, I don't know, it's curious, people slag on Jiroba a lot. For reasons I think that have a lot more to do with the first generation products than the current generation products. But, you know, looking at that $300 price on Amazon.com, and as somebody
for the 5C,
and somebody uses a 5C literally every single day attached to a desktop, I've had zero, I knock on wood, and it's backed up on Backblaze, but I've had zero issues with it. And this seems to be one of those product categories where your mileage is going to vary a lot in some cases. Anecdotally, it seems to be more issues with Mac than Windows. But it's something to think about before you buy one if you're running a Mac system. So,
yeah. And they do give you, I was trying to find the list of them, but I think I have it here. Yeah, I mean, so you can actually migrate disk packs as long as you're on the most recent firmware. Make sure you've updated firmware on like the source and the destination device before you do go to do any of this. But there's a big guide and charts on Jiroba sites on like which devices can you take the set of disks and basically just power down the old Jiroba, move the disks over to the new one, fire it back up, give it a minute or two to kind of like get its bearings and figure out what just happened. And then, the disk pack will mount and, you know, it'll just kind of like, it might have to do some migration or some kind of like manipulation behind the scenes, but it's usually seamless. It doesn't really take any time. It's just, it'll do it in the background, but you know, your data just pops up on the new device. So what's supposed to be supported is, the third generation Jiroba, the Jiroba S, the 5C, the 5D.
Yeah. I realize I have a 5D at home, not a 5C, I should point out, which is a 550 device. I should also point out that in the past, Jiroba has been an advertiser
on speaker
hardware, but it's been a long time. So just to throw that out.
Full disclosure. Yeah. So, I mean, they're usually pretty good about doing migrations and things like that forward. But the thing to note is that if you do have, like, say, a 5C, which had, I believe, a 64 terabyte volume size, not 128 like this one does, or even if you're going all the way back from like a third generation Jiroba, which I think had an even smaller volume size, if you move the disks directly over, you're stuck with whatever that volume size was. So probably your better bet especially if you're going from something that's older and you wanted to get one of these with larger disks and things like that, you should get the newer one, put the newer disks in it, mount, you know, connect both of the devices to your system, have both up at the same time, just copy all your stuff over. That way you're getting the larger volume size and no weird kind of, you know, potential issues moving forward. Even though Drobo is really good about it, I'm kind of a purist about that. Like I, you know, even with other devices where you'd have a particular type of disk array or RAID or whatnot, where it should be supported to move it over to a newer hardware, I usually prefer to just build the new thing, set it alongside the old thing, and, you know, make a copy. Usually I'll do that and just copy everything, have the new copy on the other device, and now the old device becomes the backup device.
Right.
You know, maybe it's running slower and has different limitations, but hey, at least you know, no excuse for not having another copy of your data. which is actually, that's one of the things where Drobo had gotten knocked on in the past, right? There was that one, I don't remember who the photographer was that did it, but, you know, some big, kind of big shot photographer that had originally reviewed the Drobo and then like it failed on him. So like the Drobo itself failed, not the, like the data wasn't lost. The disks were still good and everything. But the unit failed and, there was a big, you know, he made a big deal out of, oh, now my data is hostage because I have to go purchase another one of these Drobo units just to be able to plug the disks in and get my stuff back.
Well, but,
I mean,
but there's also, first of all, a NAS is not a backup. A Drobo is not a backup. They are all part of a 3-2-1 backup. You know, backup is 3-2-1, three copies on at least two different mediums, at least one off location. That's a backup. This is, you know, if you throw it on a Drobo or a NAS for that matter, right? Because we love Synology boxes. There's lots of other good stuff out there. That is a copy. You know, if he thinks he's having issues, I got, you know, one of those emails that's just so heartbreaking to get on Tech Thing where somebody's like, I was running RAID 0. There's a Marvo controller on the motherboard. I probably have to buy a motherboard with the same controller on the motherboard to get that data back. And it's like, if you're lucky.
You probably do. So, I mean, you really, you know, that whole 1-2-3 or 3-2-1 thing, like RAID does not count as an extra copy. Even if it's RAID 1, which is a mirror, which is, you know, you have one set of drives or a single drive and then another set of drives or another single drive, and they're both mirrored. So that they are copies of each other, but that doesn't count as a backup either because they're both sides are live. So if you accidentally deleted a file, it immediately gets deleted from both at the same time.
Which is why
it doesn't count. Surge.
Yeah, if a power surge takes out the motherboard, if a power surge takes out the computer, we'll talk backups in another day. But it's something to be aware of. 3-2-1. Yeah.
Treat
everything. These two locations.
Yep, and treat everything as, I usually say treat everything as a black box. Nothing to do with Drobo, but Drobos just happen to be literally black boxes. So it makes the explanation easier, I guess. Yeah.
Speaking of black boxes, I have a black box with some shininess. Did a review on the Tech Thing this week of Lenovo's Legion C730 Gaming Cube. Which is essentially a gaming PC with a handle. You can pick it up, you can carry it, and look, kids, there's me holding it up there. And you know it's a gaming PC because there's glass on the top, and there's LED lighting. And it's RGB LED lighting, although one of the drivers broke while we had it, so we're waiting for a driver update on that. Or Windows 10 broke the driver for that. But it was, they do 8700, 8700K versions. The C530 has... Core i5 versions and start at considerably lower price points. I was impressed by it, not because it's particularly hard to build a mini ITX system, but that given how many gaming PCs are out there, we so rarely see anything other than a mid tower or something that's a giant triangle or something that's designed to look like an alien face or something that's, you know what I mean? The gaming PCs tend to be big. Yeah, look. There's a big gaming PC to the next one. That's one of the other Legion designs. These are fairly subtle as far as gaming designing go. But I was really kind of jamming on how easy it is to transport. Obviously, they're going for an esports angle here. And again, for LED lighting, it's fairly subtle, the lighting options that are available for the 730. some people might be concerned that it only has a 1060. I think it's actually probably a fairly reasonable choice, given that we are in this sort of transitional phase to the RTX 20 series GPUs, and that the vast majority of the people out there are price sensitive and gaming at 1080p. Would I rather have a 1070? Sure. Would I rather have a 2070? Sure. But for most people, they're gaming at 1080p, and they're probably not quite ready to upgrade to a 20 series GPU yet, in part because there aren't a lot of RTX-enabled games available, which is super, super frustrating. I must say it's like 9 by 9.5 by 13 inches, weighs just under 20 pounds. And the 700 series, the 730s come with 16 gigabytes of RAM, and the 500 series come with 8 gigabytes of RAM. Shop around carefully. Like Radeon 570s are offered on some models, but I would rather have a 1050 Ti, which is also offered on some of the 500 series models. And it was interesting. Their drive at the on the low end systems, they do a 1 terabyte hard drive with 16 gigs of Optane memory, and on the high end systems, they do 1 terabyte hard drives or 1 terabyte hard drives paired with a 128 or 256 gigabyte SSD. So the Milo that we tested spec'd out at around $1,440, $1,444 with that Core i7-8700K and a 1060 and a 1 terabyte hard drive and 120 gigabytes of RAM. There is a VIG compared to a desktop. It's a little more expensive than a regular mid-tower configuration. Apparently LED lights and small boxes are a little more expensive, but I was... I was also impressed, like the Legion C530 cubes, they're running $800, $840 with a Core i5-8400, 8 gigs of RAM, and a 1 terabyte 7200 RPM hard drive. Would I rather have a 1 terabyte SSD? Absolutely. But again, if you're gaming, the SSDs are going to help your levels load faster, your games load faster, but they're not going to make the game run any faster. So... if you're not going to DIY a Ryzen 5 series system with, say, an AMD 590, these are some pretty nice builds. And again, you are going to pay a little bit of a premium for that compact footprint. Lenovo or Dell Inspiron gaming towers, they're either going to give you a bump up in GPU or a slightly lower price for, when you're looking at it. So you might get a 1060 instead of a 1050 Ti, or you might pay like $100 less on a system. If you're thinking, if you LAN parties, if you're into esports gatherings, if you want to be able to drag your PC around and you want a full power PC, this is definitely an option worth considering. Now we just need an easy to pack 1080p monitor or bigger. Something bigger than 1080p would be nice. But it's hard to pack monitors. Well, it's just hard to pack monitors. I just want to say that.
Yeah, but I do like that case design. It's definitely, having been to QuakeCon and events like that several times, like something like that would probably be a godsend to those guys. They're trying to lug just a standard desktop case around without a handle. You usually have to have like a cart they roll around and whatnot.
Nobody likes carrying around a mid-tower PC. It's just never fun.
Yeah.
So, I was not expecting Samsung to release new SSDs, but you got to write up on the 860 QVO 1 terabyte and 4 terabyte SATA SSDs. What's the story?
Yeah, so I don't think Samsung was planning to launch 4-bit per cell flash SSDs either. Based on back in August when I was at Flash Memory Summit, I think they were supposed to speak at Flash Memory Summit, but Intel came up on and started talking all of this 4-bit per cell stuff, and I think Samsung opted to not talk about what they were going to talk about because I don't believe they had 4-bit per cell stuff ready. Now here we are a few short months later. Lo and behold, here's some 860 QVO drives instead of EVO, like the EVO style. And yeah, it's very much the same formula as what you're used to if you understand how their previous Evo series worked, where they would have TLC flash, which has 3 bits per cell, and then they would have some SLC flash, which is 1 bit per cell, which is much faster, and that's used as a cache on the front end of the other stuff that's slower, but can store data more efficiently as far as how many bits you can fit into the space available on the flash memory. Now you take that and you up it one more notch, right? Now, instead of storing 3 bits for each cell on the mass storage part of the SSD, now they're cramming 4 bits into each cell, which means you have a very small piece of silicon inside of a chip that is, you know, a couple of dozen nanometers across, and it stores electrons, and it stores them and can be read from in such a degree where there's 16 independent levels. And then you multiply that by millions of those across the chip. And then you add multiple of those chips together, and you end up with an SSD like this. It boggles the mind that they're able to pull this off with, you know, that level of precision these days. There appear to have been some trade-offs this time, where in the past you'd have something like a Pro Series drive from Samsung, which is just 2 bits per cell, and you'd have an Evo Series drive, and in some cases the Evo might actually surpass the Pro because it had that cache, and the cache was, you know, perhaps even faster in some respects than even the Pro Series drive was. Wasn't the case here, specifically on random reads, and this is, you know, this is the kind of workload where, you know, you're just doing different things are running at the same time on your system, and things are loading from multiple places at the same time, you know, multitasking, typical kind of computer things, right? System boots up, it has to pull data from all sorts of different places at the same time. That's what's referred to as a random read. And desktop systems usually do that at a very low queue depth. In other words, they're only asking the SSD for one or two things at the same time, because usually the SSD turns around quick enough to respond before it even gets a chance to ask for the next thing. So that's the important metric there. And at these, if you go back up to that prior chart, if you look at those results for reads, they're coming in at roughly half of that performance versus even something like an 860 Evo, which is similar SSD, but 3 bits per cell, not four. And I even threw in a Crucial P1 further down the chart, which is Micron / Crucial makes a NVMe 4-bit per cell SSD, gets similar scores to even something like an 860 Evo, even, you know, and that's even a direct comparison, QLC versus, you know, QLC, basically. So it's just kind of disappointing to see that particular performance metric come in at half. That might start to encroach into the part where if you were used to SSD performance at a specific level and you were doing things where you that were like intensive random reads sort of things. I mean, obviously things differ, like games differ and whatnot, but the one that comes off the top of my head is like Ashes of the Singularity. When you go to launch that game, that game in particular is one that just does a bunch of random reads from I assume it has, you know, large files that contain all the media for the game, and it doesn't read them sequentially. It kind of bounces around them and reads all sorts of different, you know, different locations at the same time. So that would be something as an example, like where you would notice, probably affects boot times a little bit, things like that. So kind of important. Sequential performance, not bad. You know, sort of kind of like what we would expect from these drives. Yeah, the 1 terabyte was a little bit lower than normal, but, you know, in practice, probably not that bad. We have a mixed test, which does like writes while there's reads going on. Drives did okay there. Again, a little bit lower performance than a 3-bit per cell drive, but again, it's, you know, you're trying to be more economical with the drive in this case. It's supposed to be more of a budget proposition than a performance proposition. We did some cache testing because these drives are supposed to, because it's 4 bits per cell, if you try to write to that directly, it gets kind of painful, to the tune of the 1 terabyte drive, when it runs out of cache, only writes at 80 megabytes per second. That is the same speed that the Intel X25M wrote at. That is a 10-year-old.
You're not familiar with that SSD.
Yeah. So, but the key is, you should never really see that level of performance in practice. The idea of the cache is that most of the time when you're writing to the SSD, there should be enough empty cache available where it just goes into the cache and it goes full speed, or at least full serial ATA speed. So you're talking 500 plus megabytes per second. And so the 1 terabyte drive did that. It was just an odd behavior. So initially on the first pass of the test, so we tried to write to it for 60 seconds in a row, it only had 6 gigabytes of cache available, and that's the drive's bare minimum. It's supposed to be able to dynamically give you a little bit more of that. The drive was only half full when we ran this test, but we didn't see any of that dynamic stuff going on, and it was only running at the minimum amount. Now, on the flip side, it kind of immediately picked up on what we were doing, and then after that first pass, every subsequent pass was full speed. So we were able to write, 25 gig full speed, and then we gave it a breather for a variable amount of time, which is what the different passes are, even all the way down to only giving it 3 seconds between two passes, and it still was going full speed. So that was impressive. But then it was not the same case on the 4 terabyte drive. The 4 terabyte drive behaved more like it was just running out of cache and then had to write straight to the QLC area. And it did that pretty consistently across the entire span of the test. So it never really caught on to what was going on. More frustrating about that is that that is a 4 terabyte SSD that was only half full. So there should have been more than just 6 gigabytes worth of SLC there. There was plenty of room where those, these drives have the ability to dynamically say, okay, this block of flash, normally it would be 4 bits per cell. I'm just going to use it in 1 bit per cell mode. So they're able to actually kind of flip these things as long as they're empty. They can just kind of change the mode of a section of flash on the drive. This one didn't seem to be doing it. I don't know why. So best I can do is just hope for Samsung to see this in the review and just recognize, maybe we need to tweak our caching a little bit. Yeah, it's probably just a bug. But again, remember, if you're just using this in your system, you put it in mom's PC or dad's PC and he's just checking email and surfing the web on it or whatever, he's not going to be putting, more than 6 gigabytes on this at greater than 500 megabytes per second. Right. It's not going to come from anywhere unless you're doing power user type stuff. You're generally just not going to see that.
It seems like if you're looking for an affordable SSD, primarily for reads, for normal human use, this is acceptable.
Yeah. It's acceptable.
I just want to give a shout out here. We have not mentioned his name too often because he's left us to go on to Intel. but you're looking at 15 cents a gigabyte for SSDs. This is awfully close to Shroud's ideal target of 10 cents a gigabyte for SSD pricing.
It gets even closer to that because the 860 Evo launched at around 35 cents a gig. Now, there were some people commenting, and even in the office, the guys were saying, the 860 Evo is cheaper than 15 cents a gig right now. So, when I wrote that article, there were sales going on, and you could, there at even one point, you can get a 1 terabyte 860 Evo for $100, which was 10 cents a gig sale price.
Well, you can get one for $130 right now, so...
Yeah,
and
that's only 13 cents a gig, which is actually cheaper than this MSRP. So the thing to realize is Samsung's MSRPs typically run higher than the street price. And they're going to have to, when these do launch, which is supposed to be, I think, mid-December, when they actually hit the market and are for sale, they're going to have to be a lower cost than the equivalent 860 Evo. It's just how these are supposed to work. So that we should see them realistically for probably 12 cents, maybe 11 cents a gig right out of the gate is my guess. But they just wouldn't sell if they hit the market and were at 15 cents per gig, even compared to Samsung's own other product lines, right? Not only is the 15 cents a gig good, but once you consider those other facts, it's probably even better, you know, when you think about terms of street price. We might actually hit a consistent 10 cents a gig here with this product. It could happen.
Down with that. I just want to point out, I know we've mentioned it quite a few times, but SSDs are at the lowest price of the year. Memory is at the lowest price, I think, in at least a year. If you've been thinking about buying, you know, if you're thinking about buying or building a system or buying a system, it is not a bad time to do so. It's particularly good if you're looking at, you know, AMD Ryzen-based systems. Again, memory is its lowest price. We've seen it for a year. SSDs are way down over the year. The only thing that's kind of crazy still, of course, is GPUs. But at least if you shop around, there are still some stuff that shouldn't cause you apoplectic rage or just sticker shock that causes you to have emotional trauma. Right now, I'm really curious to see where these drives are in a couple months. You know, I also want to see, you know, a good $150 two terabyte drive, but I'm cheap. And I'm always looking for more for less. But even NVMe drive, like 1 terabyte Crucial NVMe drives are selling for $220 right now. So it's not bad. Not bad at all, people.
Yep.
I just want to talk about this next story super briefly because of the number of stories I saw that Nintendo was practically dead, in part because people didn't realize that Nintendo has staggering amounts of cash stored away and they're not a particularly expensive company to run day to day. But Nintendo said they sold something like $250 million over the Black Friday weekend. Between Thanksgiving and Cyber Monday, $250 million of Nintendo products were sold. So if you've been worried about whether or not they're going to be Switch games for a few more years, stop. They've already sold, I think, almost not quite 1.75 times as many Switches as they sold to the previous console. You know, it's blown away Nintendo Wii sales. They were also selling the Nintendo 3DS, the NES Classic Edition, and the Super NES Classic Edition, which, of course, are tied in perhaps to the crushing of ROM sites that we've seen in the last year. But that's a lot. I mean, they sold 3 million Switch consoles in the September quarter, which is climbing from last year, which is a problem I think Sony and Microsoft would absolutely like to have with their consoles. But yeah, that's a lot of Switches. So keep at it, Nintendo.
People, I'm just impressed to see. I didn't think that format like was still, you know, think of the competition that you have. I mean, even everybody's got a phone and phones are getting more and more capable. I was just surprised that something like a Switch would take off as much as it appears to be. It's cool.
Yeah. Also, $250,000. Just a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Command Line Heroes. It's an original podcast for geeks, by geeks, from Red Hat, an open source company that's been bringing open source technologies to the enterprise for 25 years. What is a Command Line Hero? Glad you asked. They're the developers, the programmers, the hackers, the geeks, the open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape. Command Line Heroes is hosted by Saran Yitbarak, a developer who founded Code Newbie and lives and breathes open source software. Season 2 of Command Line Heroes is all about living on the command line and tracking the changes that shape the world of open source development, from programming languages to learning about supercomputers, hybrid clouds, and more. The latest episode covers the data explosion, how big data is going to help solve big problems, and how to handle it. Kenneth Couquier explains how data has changed and how it's beginning to change us. Dr. Ellen Grant shares how Boston Children's Hospital is using open source software to transform data into individualized treatments. And Sage Weil shares how Ceph's scalable and resilient cloud storage helps manage the data flood. And there is a flood of data, people. Visit redhat.com/heroes to check it out today. Subscribe to Command Line Heroes wherever you get your podcasts. And visit redhat.com/heroes for extras and to learn more. That's redhat.com/heroes. And we thank Command Line Heroes from Red Hat for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Thank you. The the relationship between hard OCP and NVIDIA has been fractious over the years. There have been crankiness between them. I NVIDIA no longer provides hard OCP with cards, but I don't think hard OCP has ever been particularly hard on their cards or extracted any pound of flesh, Kyle and the crew over there from NVIDIA. They just pissed off NVIDIA and they got to buy their own cards now. And one of the things about that is it I think makes them particularly aware of when there are problems with cards. As Kyle writes on RTX 2080 Ti FE escapes testing by dying after 8 hours. Quote, we have spent over $4,000 on NVIDIA RTX cards on both 2080 Founders Edition and 2080 Ti Founders Edition video cards for testing here at Hard OCP. As it stands now, two of our three 2080 Ti FE cards have died on us. Another one just bit the dust and with very little fanfare this time. If you are buying one of the cards, be aware that NVIDIA basically has copped to that there have been defective early NVIDIA RTX 2080 Ti Founders Editions. Quote, some quote Kyle here again. Actually, I guess it's Keiji Maru. Kyle edited it. Quote, test escapes. There were limited test escapes. Test escapes. Quote, refers to the testing of the parts, such as resistors, capacitors, etc., that are on the PCB. Sometimes these parts are defective or of marginal quality. By using big data analytics, companies can test, monitor, track, and find bad batches of parts before they enter the final product assembly manufacturing stage. As alluded to by NVIDIA, something was missed along the way, and the bad compounds made it through quality control and into the final product. So from our understanding of what a test escape is, it would seem that NVIDIA is actually owning up to putting bad RTX 2000 series cards into the market. So,
Or basically putting cards out that have a higher than expected failure rate.
So if you have a 2080 that's puked, go to NVIDIA.com/support. They got live chat going, or you can send them an email, and they're basically saying they will take care of it. So, and they also mentioned, human error can be a contributor. When NVIDIA talks about this, quote, human error can be one of the main contributors to test escapes and RMAs. For example, an engineer may forget to adjust testing limits, and therefore less stringent tests are administered to the current wafers, allowing many more questionable devices to pass inspection. ATE freeze occurs when the measurements return to the same or similar test results over across several parts. So maybe parts get stuck in the tester or the tester hardware or software malfunctions, they say. So test results from previous chips are recorded on subsequent tests until the ATE resets itself. So in one case, NVIDIA notes a semiconductor production line, they let 2,200 units go untested before detecting a freeze. So, the other thing that was kind of crazy is they also saw an EVGA 2080 Ti XE, quote, literally burst into flames. Or as they put it, catches fire in spectacular fashion. And this was Hard OCP or Shansoft, and they had some pictures of that they posted. So that's a little frightening.
Yeah, we did one of those cards. I think the one that actually had the magic smoke obviously come out of it. The guys on our side were kind of like passing, pointing each other to various images that we found of that card, and then we were trying to figure out like what on the card is that? What could have let go on there?
Yeah, because that was a lot of magic smoke.
Yeah. And we ended up, I'm not sure where the article is right now, but we had an article that we were talking about on the podcast last night where we assembled those images and put them up as part of like a news post on the site. I think Scott Michaud wrote it up for us. And we found someone else that had done a disassembly of the same card because we didn't have that particular model. And they had good images of the front and the back of the PCB and didn't really look like there was anything. All that was there were pretty beefy inductors and some shunt capacitors. So basically all the things that were in that place on the PCB were already shorts, right? Because those are those components I just labeled, like they act as shorts normally. So the only thing we could figure is that maybe there was some overload elsewhere on the PCB because that area just happened to be where the some of the really beefy traces for the 12 volts that come into the board. Basically, the traces narrowed to like their narrowest. It was sort of like a choke point for those copper traces. And so if you were going to overload, say, the 12 volts coming in, you know, and overdraw a current, and you also your power supply has to not step in and go, hey, too much current. And like, you know, because that's supposed to be a safety feature of most power supplies. If none of those things happen properly, then that would have been the place on the PCB that would have lit up, so to speak, just, you know, copper glowing red hot sort of thing, which would have turned into, you know, magic smoke, leaving the board at a very rapid pace.
Which we're not big fans of.
No.
We like the smoke to stay inside the computer.
Yes.
Just say
it needs to stay in. And I have yet to find, you know, a good provider of magic smoke in a can that, you know, you can just kind of like spray back on there. Things start working again.
Nice.
I'd really like I really like a good can of that.
Oh my goodness. Apple says the iPhone XR has been its top selling iPhone since launch. Which somehow I feel is not particularly surprising. It's incredibly well reviewed. The component, you know, the internals are great. The camera's fantastic. There's been some questions about whether or not they are having issues with supplies. So if you're thinking about buying them for the holiday shopping season, you might want to start checking early. CNET's got an interview, and they quote Greg Joswiak, Apple's vice president of product marketing. He said, quote, "It's been our most popular iPhone each and every day since the day it became available." So, you know, they didn't start. It's funny. They didn't start selling the iPhone XR, which, you know, sells for a healthy $749 compared to the $999 iPhone XS and $1,100 iPhone XS Max. So $750 is reasonably inexpensive for a current generation iPhone.
The budget iPhone is $750.
Well, there are less expensive iPhones you can buy. For example, I think you can still buy a 7 or an 8. But what is interesting about this is, you know, analysts are saying, Apple said flat out they didn't sell as many iPhones as analysts projected in the quarter that ended on September 29. They also, in something that happened a while back, they're no longer detailing actual unit sales for iPhone and other major devices. And that's something that they've never done in the past. And what would have been like, we sold this many because we're awesome. And apparently, according to the Wall Street Journal, Apple cut production orders on all the 2018 iPhone models. So perhaps they either haven't offered enough innovation, or people have been spending a lot of money on iPhones, or people just aren't buying phones. So Apple's now fallen below its $1 trillion valuation. Apparently, it's dropped about 20% at the time of this article being posted. It's also led to us contemplating something we'll talk about later in the episode, about whether or not you should be thinking, whether or not you should be worried about tariffs impacting the cost of your electronics in the new year. But we'll get into that later on. So,
yeah.
Did you catch the news? I have a couple of friends who are Google Fi users. My co-host on Tech Things, Shannon, is loves Google Fi, except when she has to pay for data. I pay a lot more money per month because I have a guaranteed 50 gigabytes of data on my phone, which would cost me 500 gigabytes if I bought it through most projects. And it's ungated. It's not like, you know, 15 or 20 gigabytes, then they can throttle you. It's an actual full speed 50 gigabytes, which I have because my 25 gigabyte plan got doubled to 50 gigabytes, and because there was an incident at CES a couple of years ago that cost me a staggering amount of money. I may need to rethink the economics of my current phone plan, but that's a conversation that'll put everyone to sleep. But if you've been curious about Google Fi, and you know, I think Google Fi is interesting. I think Ting is interesting. Project Fi, I should say, is now Google Fi, and they added iPhones and pretty much not all the Android devices, but a pretty huge selection of Android devices. You know, one thing that you want to be aware of is that if you do have an iPhone, visual voicemail is not going to work currently. As they put it, 5 for iOS is in beta. And for me, you know, not having visual voicemail would be a killer not a killer app, but a killer, as in me killing the deal. But for Android users, it should be just fine. So a couple other, but Verge has a nice kind of summary of what's going on there. If you're thinking about moving your iPhone over to Google Fi, but you know, $20 for phone line, $10 per gigabyte of data you use. You get, you know, the data charges go up to 60 gigabytes. If you go over 15 gigabytes, they can start throttling you. Your mileage on that may vary. But if you've been looking for an alternative to one of the cell phone companies, Google's an MVNO, and they have an option for you. So at least if you have, you know, your phone is supported. But the, you know, it basically went from like a handful of Google-only phones to a pretty large list of options on there.
Yeah.
Just something to think about if you're looking to reduce your phone bill.
I think it's good so long as you're not going to use much data at all, because the data rate is kind of steep.
Yeah, well, the data rates, it's interesting. The data rate, it depends on who you're comparing to and what plan it is. And, you know,
right.
You know, for me, I mean, I'm basically paying $120 for my data, but I have a guaranteed outrageous amount of data. You know, $120 would buy me 12 gigabytes of data. Well, no, $60 would buy me 15 gigabytes of data, and then my data would be throttled on Google Fi.
Yep.
If you're, you know, if you're curious, if you want us to talk more about phone plans on This Week in Computer Hardware, tweet at Malvin Tana or at Patrick Norton. We are always out there curious what we're curious about what you're curious about, but man, you can get down a lot of rat holes really quickly with comparing plans. And if you're willing to kind of go sort of away from a major carrier, then there's a whole bunch of plans that you've probably never heard of. Sasha Sagan's crew over at PCMag.com does a great job of tracking down sort of alternative carriers or places where you can sort of pre-buy, you know, purchase plans to save money. It's interesting once you start digging into the 32,000 different people that are selling different variations on cell phone service. That's all I'm going to say, because otherwise I'll put us both to sleep. Yeah. That is an amazing article. The best cheap cell phone plans you'd never heard of by Sasha Sagan over at PCMag.com.
Yeah.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by OnDeck. OnDeck, 100% committed to small business owners with fast, easy, and tailored financing. Your time is valuable. How about getting funding in fast as 24 hours? With term loans up to $500,000, lines of credits up to $100,000, none of which require business collateral. The application process is simple. You can apply online or by phone and get approved in minutes. It won't impact your personal credit. OnDeck delivers some of the best customer service with their U.S.-based loan specialists and has an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. OnDeck has lent over $10 billion to over 80,000 small business owners. They carry a 9.8 out of 10 rating on Trustpilot. OnDeck is the secure financing service that business owners everywhere can truly rely on. Their simple and secure web platform and mobile app make it easy to access your account anywhere, anytime. If you're a small business owner and need to access capital, go to ondeck.com/twitch right now. And as a listener to This Week in Computer Hardware, you'll receive a free consultation with one of their U.S.-based loan specialists. Apply online or by phone and get approved in minutes. Go to ondeck.com/twitch. That's ondeck.com/twitch for your free consultation now. That's ondeck.com/twitch. We want to thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. I hate those moments when I get my cable wrapped around my arm. But I hate wireless devices not working properly or overly compressing my audio when I'm making a podcast. Are you, as somebody who keeps a fairly close eye on SSDs and SSD pricing, can you kind of recognize any tariffs that have impacted current prices? And are you concerned about what's going on, what's coming in January?
Well, as far as current prices go, like, the prices have been pretty good. lately.
Yeah.
Haven't noticed any sudden jumps or anything like that. Now, maybe that's just because they were able to absorb that with margins, but I don't think there's really that much margin with the way that these SSD makers are kind of, you know, trying to hack and slash to compete with each other. Yeah, I haven't really seen much on the SSD front, but there's supposedly some tariffs coming, maybe?
Well, so there's part of what this article up on CNET that kind of caught my eye. Your next iPhone might cost more because of the U.S.-China trade war, which is a little alarmist. The president suggested that he might expand the tariffs that are coming in January. And 25% tariffs are starting January 1st. Something like 1,100 types of products, including, I like this line. At this point, our government has, quote, specifically excluded goods commonly purchased by American consumers, such as cellular telephones or televisions. So iPhones, Android phones are exempt, laptops are exempt, computers are exempt for the most part. And the tariffs have been interesting because essentially companies could appeal,
right.
Some products would have fallen under the original tariffs or would have been subject to the 25% tariffs that are coming. Apple wrote a note to the U.S. trade representatives and the items were removed from the tariff lift. And it's interesting. So you can actually get things removed from the tariff list or could at that point. But I'm really curious what people are thinking about this or if they're seeing an impact on this. It's interesting because obviously things are kind of complicated, but looking at GM this week, like GM gets $500 million in tax breaks and then they're turning around and shutting down operations, which is also particularly fraught if you're from the Detroit area, because eminent domain was used to take a lot of the land that was leveled to create the facilities that are being shut down in Detroit by GM. But I'm curious what people are thinking about. I'm curious to see, what's going to exactly be impacted or if the scope of the tariffs are going to be impacted so they impact more people. I'm curious what people are thinking about. And, if you want to get into a really not exciting read, the documentation that goes around the tariff lists will definitely
put you to sleep.
Well,
it's definitely dry.
Yeah, dry is a gracious word for it.
Yeah, but I tell you what, 25%, man, that's a big chunk.
Yeah, it is.
Right? Like, that's just to try to do that high of a number on, electronics and whatnot. I don't think that's really in the best interests of, the people that are just trying to buy the stuff.
Yeah, and it's also, it's a crazy list because you've got everything from diesel electric locomotives, electronic integrated circuits, memories, electronic integrated circuits, amplifiers, other antennas and antenna reflectors of all kinds of parts for use. And feel free to email or tweet at Patrick Norton if you are an expert on this stuff, because it's incredibly dense and it's incredibly, iron or steel bridge or bridge sections. Man, we just built a bridge over here and that stuff was expensive to begin with. And I'm all for U.S., manufacturing jobs. But in some cases, structural steel can no longer be made. Certain types of structural steels, we just don't have the ability to make them in the United States. So I'm getting a little far off my original thought, which was kind of contemplating what tariffs are coming and what people are thinking about that. USTR.gov is the website if you want to look at what's coming or what's currently being hit under the tariffs. But the Office of the United States Trade Representative, it's a little dry, but it's really interesting. And something I hope to understand a little bit better as we lean towards CES in January and the increased tariffs that are coming. So, I don't know. Interesting stuff. At least to me. And if it's not interesting, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Speaking of randomly titled articles about Microsoft, to change the subject awkwardly and quickly,
I just picked one here, but on PC Perspective podcast last night, we were talking about, like, there was just a chunk of these. There was probably in the past week alone, I think there was like three or four different news posts Jeremy made, all related to separate patch related bugs for Windows 10. And it just kind of like led into this big, you know, I just picked one, but basically the long and short of it is Microsoft is not doing great lately with rolling out patches to try to fix things, you know, because patches usually have bug fixes. But lately, they've even had to delay like a major update to Windows 10 and pull it back. And it's even still to get it now. I think they're finally starting to push out the, what was it? I think the October update, I think is what it was that was delayed. But they just kind of keep screwing this up, right? And the thing that's been pointed out is that the majority of these issues are things that, you know, Microsoft has this ability to enter into fast ring builds of Windows where you're getting the sort of the pre-release code before it gets pushed out to the masses. And if you're willing to volunteer to be part of that, you get the newer features earlier and you get to play around with it under the understanding that, hey, this is beta, right? And they have this feedback portal that's a great idea. Like, you have these people willing to try the newer thing early and willing to provide feedback and bugs and things that they run into. But in almost all these cases where they've pushed out an update and then, you know, it's messed other things up on people's systems, these bugs had already been reported and even upvoted. You know, it's even sort of like a community moderated sort of, you know, feedback hub that Microsoft's running. So they have this gold mine of information. It's just that they don't seem to be paying attention to it. You know, and this goes all the way back. The example I brought up last night when we were talking about it with the other guys was, remember that that update that came out that broke everybody's webcam on Windows 10, right? That was, I think, one of the highest moderated, you know, like upvoted, and it was not a little back corner issue on the bug reporting forum there, or the feedback hub or whatever Microsoft calls it, right? It was definitely something people were pointing out, and yet that update just came out anyway and had a pretty significant impact. Like, in my opinion, that should have been the last time that something like that happened, where something was being fed back and, you know, kind of slipped under the radar. So it should not still be happening now, and it definitely shouldn't be happening rapid fire, multiple occurrences of it in 1 week. So, you know, like the longer Windows 10 is out, the longer you have people, you know, potentially moving away from the Windows 7s and the Windows 8s. And so the market share of Windows 10 is, you know, theoretically keeps growing, which means that the stakes are getting only higher and higher for them to not mess this up moving forward. You know, because in an ideal world, as far as Microsoft would go, every system would be on Windows 10, right? So what happens when you push out a patch to break something in a perfect world for them, in a perfect world, right? What happens then if everybody is on this now, nobody's on the older stuff, and you push out this patch where people were feeding back that there was a, you know, potentially major issue, and we'll just roll it out anyway, you know, without fixing that bug. So, yeah, it needs to get better. I mean, I know they've scaled back their own internal testing thing, but they should not also be ignoring the community feedback, the free community feedback that they have available at their disposal.
So much feedback. So free.
Yeah.
Not free, but something that always makes me happy is mouse feet. I just want to say that. And,
you know,
I have not seen mouse feet in a while, but go ahead.
I am tickled that you're bringing this up, because I know that sounds so funny and ironic and just silly, but like, I have a Logitech G900 mouse, which is not that old, you know, maybe a year or two old or something like that. The left mouse button has already started having the whole, like, you know, inadvertently double and triple and 10 times clicking something because the switch is starting to fail in that button. Ooh. And this is my home. This isn't even the work mouse. Like, this is just the home mouse, and it doesn't really get clicked that much. But I've already ordered replacement switches. You can go in there, and if you're handy with a soldering iron, you can just kind of, you know, I'm not going to replace a $100 plus mouse just because of a, you know, $1 switch, right? But right. To get in there, you have to peel back the mouse feet. And they don't usually stick back on as nicely as they were originally. And I have been blowing this off, and I totally, it escaped my brain that buying replacement mouse feet like was a thing. And there were companies
skates. That you can also that call even, them skates.
Also call them skates. But that, you know, not only is it a thing, but it's like people buy them because they give like some of them are better than the original and stuff like that, right? Like probably like these, where if you make them out of PTFE, you know, that like non-stick sort of material, then, you know, it makes the mouse slide across the mouse pad even that much better, right? So I'm going to kill two birds with one stone now. I saw you put this article in the notes, and I've already ordered these for my mouse. So excellent. Now when they show up, I will be able to correctly replace this broken switch or the defective switch in my mouse and be able to actually put the skates back on the thing.
I just think it's delightful.
I totally hijacked your article.
No, this is you're ahead of me because I have a mouse in particular that, you know, first of all, we should give a shout out to Tech Power Up. TechPowerUp.com is the website. CorePad Skates Mouse Feet Review. Van Eer wrote it up for TechPowerUp.com. And these are one, it's a great write-up. Two, it made us both aware of it. Three, CorePad does some really cool products. And what's nice about this is unlike if you remember, quote, Teflon tape, which the owner of that trademark very assiduously told everyone there is no Teflon tape. Quit calling it Teflon tape. We do not make tape. The tape you are referring to has PTFE in it or something like that.
Right.
But polytetrafluoroethylene being the common name, if you will, of stuff that's based on Teflon or the original Teflon formula. In any case, these are PTFE feet. They are pre-cut, which I think is really fantastic because if you've ever tried to cut PTFE tape or padding to size, you will appreciate the fact that these are pre-cut and ready to go. So, one, I'm glad that you were so excited about this. Two, I'm glad that your mouse is getting renovated, not going to a landfill. Three, I will be buying some CorePad skates mouse feet. And four, again, props to Van Eer over at techpowerup.com for CorePad skates mouse feet review because it has brought so much joy to so many lives here at This Week in Computer Hardware. So,
yeah, the pre-cut is key, especially, you know, I mean, heck, this mouse has like seven different pads on the bottom and they're all different shapes and sizes and good luck trying to get that right. You know, and if you don't do it right, then the edge, even if it's the most non-stick thing possible, you don't cut it to fit the space right, then you have an edge that kind of sticks up from the surface and it catches on things and it's totally defeats the purpose. So yeah, pre-cut is the way to go.
It's nice when things fit. You know what else is nice? Reading the reviews up at pcper.com. Are there any reviews you can tell us about? Anything?
Well, we were just talking about a couple of storage things I was working on. I know Ken's working on some video card review. I just didn't ask him which one. It's probably just another, you know, but there's no new, I don't think there's any new stuff coming. Thank goodness we've exhausted all of the major launches in CPUs, GPUs, and all that other stuff lately. Still feel bad for Ken, who's, I think, still trying to catch up on sleep from the one
he
or two
can
weeks.
Sleep when he's dead.
Yeah. Well, he's going to get there soon if he keeps going the pace he was going for those couple of weeks. I'm working on some Samsung Enterprise SSDs.
Ooh.
Something we've never reviewed because they've never really, it's just not a thing that Samsung has sold in the channel. Which is the marketing speak for just or the vendor speak for just, you know, it's just on the market, generally speaking, as opposed to only being gobbled up by OEMs that want to, you know, buy 20,000 of them and stick them in a room full of servers.
Right.
So yeah, Samsung a month or two back had me out to an event and where they were talking about, hey, we're gonna finally do what you guys have been asking for, and that is have enterprise SSDs available. Like average Joe can buy these, small business sort of cool thing. Again, they're enterprise SSDs. They're not meant for consumer, you know, just stick it in your gaming rig, right? But you know, if you have enterprise workloads, databases, things like that that need to be on SSD more tailored for that purpose, they're coming. And you know, they've already been announced and launched. There's no real secrets there. But I have a round of them that I've been testing, and I just need to go through all the data and write it up. And I think in the short term we might even take a look at the Samsung Z SSD, which is supposed to be their answer to Optane and Crosspoint. Not using Crosspoint, but not even anything equivalent to Crosspoint. Supposedly Samsung is able to, reportedly, and they claim that they can get close to those speeds still just using NAND, just in straight SLC mode. So I'm not sure what magic voodoo they've done to that media to be able to make it go as quickly as they claim it can, but I'm very interested to actually lay my hands on it and see it actually go that fast. Again, in something that you can actually buy, supposedly. We'll see. Yeah, so I'm working on that. You know, Ken's working on some other stuff. Jim's working on stuff. Jim edited the podcast himself for the first time last night, since he's trying to take over from all the, you know, take over all the various reins from Ryan, who kind of like, hey guys, I'm taking off for Intel. Catch you later. So poor Jim is left to try to, you know, learn the ropes, so to speak, at the site. But he's doing a good job.
Yay, Jim. Yeah. Oh my goodness. We had a whole bunch of stuff to talk about, including some of the deals we saw Black Friday on AVXL this week, the home theater and audio podcast I host with Robert Herron. There's some pretty fantastic speaker deals that are still running from a couple of different companies out there. We have the early word on what's going on with next generation processing on LG's OLED televisions, and couple other things in there. I will let you go over to avxl.com and find out for yourself. And of course, as we mentioned, we had a review of Lenovo's Legion C730 gaming cube, that gaming PC with a handle, on the tech thing this week, TEKTHING. Shannon got into a deep relationship with Huawei's latest MateBook Pro X, and it's interesting comparing that to a Dell XPS. And I also did a bunch of websites. If you are interested in weather or visualizing wind, or if you didn't know that the NOAA has some pretty amazing real-time satellite imagery that you can browse, just like you're in a Neal Stephenson novel, you should head on over to Tech Thing and give that one a listen. Right now, ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. And you can find more episodes, information on how to subscribe. You can just search for TWICH in your favorite podcasting tool, or go to twit.tv/twitch. And we want to thank each and every one of you for listening, our sponsors for their support, and the whole Twit crew for making it possible. But seriously, though, it's all about you. You! Tweet at Malvin Ton or at Patrick Norton if you got questions, or if you're curious about stuff or have things you want to see us cover. And as always, thank you so much for listening. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Alan Malventano.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.